Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I am your host, Corey Fleck, and I appreciate all of you joining us after what was the last full week of trading. We have Christmas coming up on Friday. It's going to be a shortened week for the next 2 weeks, but boy, oh boy, there was a lot that went on this week. And a lot that we need to, I think, take a step back and understand what's happened to these markets in the last, really, just couple months. I'm kicking off this show with Rick Bensignor. He is the president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes his institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors, which is read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. Also writes a retail newsletter called In the No Trader. And he did start up a new piece called 7-Eleven, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs. Now, Rick, big picture here. As I mentioned, the last couple months, it seems like everything has moved higher. It doesn't matter what you look at outside of, say, bonds and the dollar. It's been a great environment for investors as long as you have been invested and not simply holding cash, especially the US dollar, because that keeps on moving lower. Before we get into some of the individual market moves, what do you take away from markets like this where clearly everyone's excited or everyone is optimistic? And the fact of the matter is everything's going higher. So why not be confident and optimistic?
Well, Corey, I agree with you that for the most part, everything is going higher, let's say barring the dollar when we look across, you know, the asset classes. Although I guess if we look in bond price terms, they're going lower a bit as rates move up, but rates are going higher in general. But, you know, this is the result of two big things. One was the big sell-off earlier this year, which got many people out. I was actually out for a walk with a neighbor a couple days ago, and he was telling me that he sold a lot out in the big March-April decline and has yet to come back in. And, you know, that to me is probably similar to many people who are individual investors who rightfully got spooked in the spring, but unfortunately, wrongfully, didn't get back in. And part of that is, I think, in behavioral finance, we would allude to the anchoring bias that people hate to buy back at a higher price than they sold out. So if they sold out in the depths of the March-April decline, then chances are if they didn't immediately react and get back in, they saw prices being higher than where they sold. So they were waiting to get back to at least the level to where they sold out at to get back in. And the problem was they never got that opportunity. And the more the market went up, the more they get frustrated and just say, well, you know, this is a crazy market. It's going up. And there's no reason for it to go up in this COVID environment. And a lot of that is rational thinking. I think probably investors or even the general public may be more rational about the thinking than the investors who have pushed this market higher. But nonetheless, the market is higher. And I think a lot of individual investors have that really difficult time paying higher than where they sold. So they've missed a lot of this rally. And whether they're first coming back in now, which seems, you know, you look at some of the statistics and there's huge money inflows coming in now. How much of it is pure institutional as compared to retail, I don't know. But so that's certainly one of the big factors. The other thing is that Fed Chairman Powell, again, reiterated this past week that there is whatever tools necessary the Fed has to keep the money spigots open and to keep, you know, the economy liquid as best they can. And certainly investors like that. And it's not really new news from the chairman, but it's reiterated news. And so there just isn't a lot at this point that's newly negative. Anything related to COVID has been around for months, if anything, now that the vaccines are starting to be made available in the U.S., and it's still going to easily take 6 months, I suppose, before the bulk of the population gets vaccinated, for those who choose to take it. But the news, when you look at things in general, the liquidity, a lot of it honestly just goes back to the old don't fight the Fed. When the Fed's going to pump money into the system and continually tells you that they will do that as often as needed to keep the system afloat and healthy, equity markets tend to move higher. And, you know, look, I've picked a few times along this post-spring rally to lighten up on longs and to hedge my portfolio and recommend hedging client portfolios. But the reality is that we end up closing out the hedges generally with, you know, a couple of percent that the markets move higher than where we put the hedges on. And we've lost some opportunity cost for that percent of the portfolio that we've hedged. But by and large, the market moves higher. It keeps moving higher. We hit all-time highs earlier today before the market sold off in most of the key equity indices in the U.S. And I'll allude back to, and I'll probably talk about this more in coming months, but all the way back in 2013 when I was at Wells Fargo as their head of trading strategy, one of the last pieces I wrote for them before I left the firm, it was June of 2013, I think. Maybe 2014, was at, and the S&P was trading at 2,000 at the time. And the headline on the piece was that the S&P will trade 5,000 by the end in 10 years. And we just may do that. You know, we're still only in 2020. We're already in the mid 3,000s. We've only got less than 1,400 points to go. We could easily get there in the next 2 years. And, it's, you know, there's been a lot of up and down movement in between, but the U.S. stock market is a pretty darn hard place to outperform over time if you stay as, you know, an invested investor.
Do you think it's going to stay that way, though, Rick? Because in all fairness, U.S. markets have outperformed broadly a lot of other markets. But over the last year or two, there has been a little maybe catch up by some of these other markets or lack of complete outperformance by the U.S. markets. Do you see any of that changing in terms of outside money, maybe focusing outside the U.S.?
Yeah, it's a good question, Corey. And earlier this year, I think it was over the summer, I suggested people start looking at Germany as a place. And of course, Germany is the powerhouse of the EU economy. And I suggested that Germany could outperform the S&P till year end. And, you know, I think given how much the S&P has pulled up now, I haven't looked at it in the last 2 weeks, but, you know, Germany's held its own. But I'm not sure if it's actually literally outperformed or not. But you know, we are seeing some other major global indices moving higher too, and it's not just in Europe. We're seeing Japan on a breakout too, and China's actually done a pretty good job of bouncing back from where they were off of the March lows. Whether or not as we go into 2021, I haven't yet put out my outlook for 2021. And I'll be working on it in the next week and a half. And they, you know, that is one of the things I'll take a look at. So I think there'll likely be some catch up, but you kind of still have the U.S. as the top dog here. And I think something has to change in a big way for that not to be the case. So instead of the spread between U.S. performance and, let's say, European equity performance being so large, it can still slowly come in, but I'm not sure that in a pair trade situation, I want to be long Europe, you know, versus the S&P. I've got to do a little more work on that before, you know, I kind of fill your listeners in on that. That's something next month we can talk about, because at that point I'll have my analysis done.
Okay. Hey, that sounds good. Let's talk about the overall trend, though, recently, which is this reflation or inflation trade. You look across the board, oil is almost at $50 a barrel. Copper continues to break higher. Gold has been popping higher. Bitcoin just broke 23,000. We'll go one by one through these sectors, but your takeaway from this inflation or reflation trade?
Yeah, I think the market, so on the front page of the institutional report each week, the lower third of it is a table that looks at 10 different markets. and they include the U.S. dollar and the U.S. 10-year gold and gold stocks, oil, the CRB index, emerging market stocks, the S&P and NASDAQ, and then some emerging market bonds that are priced in local currencies. And I'll look at those in kind of where they are in relation to some key technical levels. And I'll use the 9-week midpoint of price, the 26 midpoint week midpoint of price, where they are in relation to their Ichimoku cloud, and kind of come up with a table. And this table is a table that helps me define, depending upon where, if we're above or below these levels and collectively how they look, it gives me a very good clue about upcoming investor thoughts about inflation coming up or deflation coming up. And for 5 or 6 weeks running now, which is the longest stretch we've had in quite some time, it's showing inflationary pressures. And it's been consistent. And we haven't seen that at all since the COVID sell-off we saw in the spring. This is the first time that we've gone, let's say, 5 or 6 weeks in a row with this table indicating upcoming inflationary pressures. And it'll be no different after this week. Basically, you've got equities making highs, you've got commodities bouncing nicely, and obviously oil, you know, oil to me is the big one I just don't get. You know, it's oil's at $49.10 right now for the February WTI contract. You know, so round numbers, as you say, we're almost at $50 oil. I couldn't even make sense of it at $40 oil. There's no more increased demand now than there was when it was at $40, because you still have very limited driving, very, very limited companies using the demand for energy and office buildings. All these things are still quite limited because of COVID, and yet we've just again rallied another 20%. And don't forget that the $40 price in oil just a month ago was up from single digits back in the spring. So I've completely missed this rally in oil. Simply looking at, logically what's going on and plenty of oil in storage and demand being moderate, and yet the price has just dramatically increased. And I can't quite wrap my head around that other than sometimes futures markets really become paper markets, meaning that the funds can keep pushing a market in a certain direction. So just to give you an example, let's say at some point after oil having fallen from $50 in the spring all the way down to single digits and comes back up, and maybe whether it was at $25, $30, at some point funds, their models have turned bullish. And there's nothing that oil has done to stop them from being bullish. And the more oil goes up, the more they'll buy more contracts of oil. So the funds are long. They've gotten recently, those that were short in and around 40 that we stayed for months got squeezed out in the last few weeks as oil has dramatically risen. And like I said, this is, I've been a global macro strategist for, dare I say, dozens of years, and I still can't get my head around this one. So luckily, I haven't been short oil. I'll lean short from a trading perspective, but unfortunately, I missed the entire rally.
What do you think has changed in these funds' minds or in these big money managers' minds where, look, interest rates have been low for a while. The Fed, other central banks, they have been easy for quite a while. But all of a sudden now that money, instead of just landing into, say, the equity market or in the high-flying tech stocks, it's starting to land in these commodities broadly.
There's a lot of funds that really have very little interest or care in the commodity space. The commodity space tends to be much more of a niche space. But a standard equity fund, certainly, let's say they're benchmarked to the S&P, they're going to have some exposure to material type stocks. And the material stocks often have some relations, not direct relation, with what the underlying commodity is doing, such that, let's say, if we talk about gold, gold stocks often move in the direction that gold bullion moves. But there's plenty of times they actually move in opposite directions. They happen to be both moving up now because you have a significantly weakening U.S. dollar. and that helps the price of gold. And it's helped if you actually, for your listeners, if you were to pull up a chart of the U.S. dollar index, what on the street, the ticker is DXY, and we often call it Dixie. If you look at a chart of the dollar index, it peaked at 102 in March at the same time stocks bottomed. So people fled into the dollar when stocks were selling off in the spring. Since stocks have done a massive turnaround and moved higher, the U.S. dollar has done a massive turnaround and is trading now near 90 off of a 102 high. And, you know, for the U.S. dollar index, for the benchmark currency of the world, a 12% move down is a rather significant move in a matter of, you know, I don't know, let's just say 7-8 months. So as long as the dollar keeps going down in general, that's good for U.S. equities. It's good for emerging market stocks, and it's good for commodities. So I have our investors long commodities and short the dollar, and we've been that way for months.
Are there any commodities that you prefer, one over the other, that you think has some of the best prospects into next year?
I'm actually getting closer to shorting copper after this huge run. March copper is trading, let's say, 363 or so. I think another, I don't know, 10, 15, what do we got? 363. So something between 370 and 380, I think, is the end of the copper run, at least for now. So I'm probably going to look to short that because I just think at that point it'll be really overdone relative to prior moves and you know, other metrics that I'm looking at. I still like gold. I like silver. Platinum's on a recent breakout. I was early in platinum. I ended up buying it last February, thinking it was on a breakout then, and it ended up being a false breakout, and it cost me some money. But I've gotten back into it, and now platinum has moved up to all time highs, and I think platinum could go. I think platinum's got a shot for, you know, 30% higher this coming year. Because the funds really still haven't jumped on board the platinum move, and it's now over $1,000. It's near $1,040, and I think that's, you know, a market that, not that again, a lot of people in the world look at the price of platinum or trade it, but it is a tradable commodity. It's not nearly as liquid as gold or silver is, and there's even an ETF that's PPLT, Peter Larry Tom. You know, that tracks the price of platinum. That's something that, you know, I think can do decently next year, and possibly even better than gold, just because gold's run up so much. And now you're starting to see the potential, and there's no facts behind this yet, but the potential that cryptos are starting to maybe take some interest from gold buyers away to diversify and go into the crypto space. You know, Bitcoin at $23,000. In the past, I have stayed away from writing about Bitcoin. It's not something I really care about. Last week I mentioned, just because, you know, it was breaking to new highs or playing around new highs near 20,000. I mentioned that, the entire move up from 13,000 to 20,000 had not budged open interest in the futures contracts at all upward. And typically, a good bull market is going to see open interest move in the direction of the major trend. And open interest had been flat, and yet Bitcoin moved up 50%. So I said, look, that means that shorts are covering to prior longs, and that there's no movement in open interest. And it just, you know, and then what happens this week? Bitcoin explodes from 18,000 to 23,000. So there's a lot of craziness going on, and maybe there are funds out there buying Bitcoin instead of buying gold, or at least diversifying and getting some exposure to Bitcoin. It's still a new market. I don't recommend it to people to play. You have to really, to me, you have to understand what you're playing, and I still don't understand Bitcoin, but, you know, for some people it's going to be a market to trade. And if you're going to trade it, you have to be, I'd almost say, as a speculator, even if you buy one Bitcoin for $23,000, you have to fully expect that any time during the life that you own it, it could easily fall 50% or more at any time, and you just have to be prepared for that. So if you don't have the money to lose either 50% or even more percent of that, then you shouldn't buy it. It's really, really, if you have excess risk capital and you're willing to, you know, be a pure speculator. And think about Bitcoin too. You are playing the greater fool theory. You can't tell me what the true value of Bitcoin is. It's not like other commodities that there is a basic need. There are no natural hedgers for Bitcoin. Last week I looked, the open interest for small speculators showed 7 times as many long contracts as short. So if you buy Bitcoin, you are hoping that somebody's a bigger fool than you are to pay higher than your price. Economically, I can't. There is no natural hedger the way a farmer is a hedger for corn, right? They grow corn. They want to hedge their price, so they'll sell futures against their inventory. Nobody has inventory of Bitcoin except for a few people in the world. It's not enough of a business that you can look at, analyze. This is a pure speculative run, and maybe it goes to 50,000 or 100,000. If it does, am I going to be on board? I'm not. And it's just not something I can get my hands around. And I'm okay on that.
I'm glad you took us there because, yeah, it has garnered a lot of attention, rightfully so. Bitcoin has just kept on moving higher. Let's take a step back then and look at the other side. What do you think it would take, or what do the commodity bulls need to be aware of that could happen, that could pull back or draw down a lot of this optimism around commodities as we head into 2021?
I think you'd have to see a shift more than just a small short covering move in the dollar. You'd probably have to get the dollar index back above and stay above 94 from the current roughly 90 level. That would spook a lot of people who are short the dollar. And if the dollar makes that much of a bounce, then you're going to see gold come off. You're going to see all the things that have done well as the dollar fall decline, including, I suspect, U.S. equities, because these really are mirror images charts. So the dollar declining is almost exactly the opposite image of U.S. stocks rallying. And so if the dollar rallies, I don't think stocks will not rally. A dollar rally will put pressure into U.S. equities. So that would be the surprise. What would make that happen? One could be too many shorts in the dollar already, where if you got some good news, something that would be bullish the dollar, you know, you get a big squeeze come. So again, a trading squeeze of 1 full point, even 2 points in the dollar, is not going to make me think that the dollar's done going down. I've long said for months I've had 87.50 as a minimum 2021 target, downside target. And, you know, I didn't know how long it would take us to get down there, so that's why I had it as a minimum downside target in 2021. We've already gotten, you know, beneath 90 this year, so that could easily happen in the first or second quarter of the year. And it doesn't mean the dollar can't fall further than that, but that's my, you know, kind of initial target for this down move. If something materially changes to get the dollar bullish, then you could see the negative impact on the commodity side as well as the U.S. equity side.
Rick, we're going to wrap it up there. Great comments. Very interesting to end this year, too. And again, everything does seem to be going higher. People obviously are very excited about that. I get it. But I do think we need to understand why it's moving higher, and also just make sure we understand what could happen on the other side of things. But either way, moving into 2021, a lot of people are excited, and especially in the resource sector commodities, because those have performed very well as well. Rick, great chatting with you, buddy. I look forward to chatting with you in the new year. I hope you have a very Merry Christmas, a great holiday season, and a Happy New Year.
You too, Corey. Thanks so much. Very best to you and your family.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Rick Bensignor. We covered a lot of different markets and really summarized a lot of what happened this year and looking into next year. In the next two segments, I am focusing a bit more on the resource sector, let's call it. I am chatting right now with Steve Todoruk. He is an investment executive over at Sprott Global. Steve's been on the show a number of times now over the past few months, and he does always offer to take a look and rank any of the stocks that you, our listeners, hold in your portfolio. All you need to do is email Steve or email myself. I will post Steve's email address within the weekend show posting. Now, again, due to compliance issues, Steve and I cannot talk about specific stocks, but we can talk big picture. And Steve, you are focused on discovery plays. You are constantly out there looking for new discoveries and companies that are expanding on discoveries. This ties into the optionality plays. Now, obviously, optionality plays come back on the radar as the metals prices move higher. And in all fairness, they can provide some nice torque to the underlying metals price. But give me your thoughts on what you think of optionality plays as an investment.
I think optionality plays are appealing to, call them, layman investors that don't want to have to roll up their sleeves to do the deep, hard digging and homework to find out what good companies are. It's tried and proven. We've seen companies over the decades that, you know, called optionality plays, and with a rising gold or silver price, you know, those share prices go up. They've got, you know, one to a number of deposits that are all sub-economic. You know, even at $1,800 gold, I doubt that one of the optionality plays has a deposit that would work at today's gold price. They need significantly higher, you know, metal prices. And I just don't care to play that game. It's at the end of the day, you've got to do something. You've got to sell your stock if you're going to make money, type of thing. And what's your catalyst for deciding when to sell it? In my niche into discovery plays, you know, my exit strategy is waving goodbye to a big company taking us over. So there's an end goal that I got a gut feeling for that's going to be there. And with an optionality play, that isn't there. You know, most of these optionality play deposits are so uneconomic. They're usually in really remote areas or extremely rugged, mountainous, glaciers, out in the middle of nowhere where you need to start by building a $1 billion natural gas line to get out to it. I sort of say that when I was a geologist working in the field, when I got up in the morning to head out in the bush, the boss, you know, never said, you know, why don't you go try finding a sub-economic deposit for the company today? You know, that's not how it happens. They want economic deposits to mine for 10 to 50 years type of thing. So just maybe I'm tainted being a geologist, but it's I just shake my head. There's much better companies that you can sleep better at night. And again, you want to have some kind of an exit strategy as to when you're going to sell. And I've got my exit strategy steadfast, whereas optionality plays, I don't know, I guess you just got to get up out of bed one day and say, today's the day to sell.
Yeah, unfortunately, these optionality plays, they can be some of the most heavily promoted as well, but they are fairly easy to distinguish, right? You look at some of their economic studies and they show that, well, now they might be showing that they might make a little bit of money at current prices, but what is a lower threshold that you like to look at when you look at economic studies or some sort of, I guess, valuation metrics to isolate whether it is truly an optionality play or if it does make money at a lower level, kind of a threshold for you?
Well, I'd like to see it in today's world, a company, if it was mining, you know, the deposits I'm involved in juniors, that they could still make a profit at $1,000 or $1,200 gold price. You know, the lower you can go to see, you know, to see if you can still make a profit. That's how you define quality, you know, a world-class mine type of thing. So if you crunch numbers today and you need $1,500 gold price, I'm not too keen on that. That's why most of the big mining companies are calculating the reserves at much lower prices than what we've got today. They're saying, hey, this is wonderful. You know, yeah, we've got a year under our belt, you know, selling gold between $1,500, $1,800. that's wonderful, but we don't know if that's going to, they almost bank it's not going to happen. The high gold prices are going to stay here. They're always looking and assuming, you know, we know there's another correction coming in the commodity cycle. We just don't know when. So let's be prepared for it.
Yeah, it's important to protect your downside risk. And it's nice to see that the majors are doing that too, because they did get burned at the tail end of the last bull market. Does that mean then broadly that every time you hear a company say that they are a mineral bank, that usually means that they are an optionality play and you stay away?
Yes, absolutely.
Let's also talk about some M&A in the sector, because M&A has started to pick up, especially at the tail end of this year. We're not necessarily seeing majors buy these smaller companies, but we are seeing some of the mid-tiers and some of the generally smaller scale producers start to accumulate or bring in new projects. How do you see this carrying into next year?
I think it'll continue, not at a rapid pace, because you know, there's got to be a fit. Like there's a quite high profile merger this week between a bigger, you know, call it bigger mid-tier gold miner and a, you know, call it a top junior that not only explores, but they got a couple of mines. And one, the key part to the whole fit was they've got a 9 million ounce gold deposit in Canada. And the bigger companies got mines in Brazil and whatnot, i.e. in the higher risk countries. So and that company will trade at a discount. I mean, whoever you are, whether you're in Burkina Faso or Mali or Brazil, those are deemed to be higher risk in the marketplace. So the market's going to assign a higher discount rate type of thing. So by this bigger company acquiring a new good-sized project in Canada, low risk, overall they'll lower their country risk profile, and that should result in a re-rating pushing their share price higher. So there's reasons like that why you see M&A. And then, you know, I don't necessarily go looking for that. But, you know, again, discovery play, my exit strategy is always if we can grow this into a good quality, valuable deposit, we should be taken over by a big company. And that's our exit strategy. We sell it all on the announcement of takeover. So that's the M&A I'm looking for. And like I say, there's always going to be some, but I'm not expecting 10 or 20. Mergers and acquisitions this year. Maybe we get 3 to 5 or 6.
Yeah, it really takes time for M&A to build up steam. And in all fairness, when M&A is screaming and there's M&A deals, it seems like every week or almost every day, that sometimes indicates the top of a market too. So something to consider there. You mentioned the potential re-rate potential. On the back of at least some of these recent M&As, the market hasn't exactly taken them all that kindly. They haven't totally sold off these shares, but the market, I don't know, seems a bit slow to react to some of these M&A transactions. What's your takeaway from that?
Well, I guess it depends on how high profile the two companies are involved in the merger. You know, how loved are they, or are they just so-so? You know, are they equals, or is one a lot bigger than the smaller one type of thing? You almost always see the bigger company, when they announce that they're issuing shares of dilution, their stock is going down at least temporarily, whereas the other juniors usually goes up. In this high profile merger today, there really wasn't much of a premium offered. There will be a bit of a premium via a spin-out company, but my understanding is that the little company had a fair number of short positions against it. So right out of the left field, when this merger is announced, the stock went up, and the guys holding the shorts had to cover, and that pushed the stock up very nicely. So something a little different there.
Now, just final comment when it comes to M&A, you still focused a bit more in safer jurisdictions. Do you see those still being the leaders in terms of investor interest and also M&A interest?
I try to, like I've been talking lately, you know, it's magical, you know, what's up with Western Australia, perfect country for mining, you know, low risk. And we've got 4 very good looking discoveries, at least 4, you know, for me to get involved in a discovery in Brazil or the Congo, you know, or some other Bolivia, some other high risk countries, Russia, it would have to be absolutely spectacular, you know, world-class potential. And I don't think I need to worry about that anytime soon, because they rarely happen. But if I see an opportunity like that, I'd take a look at it.
All right, Steve, we will wrap it up here. It's great having you on the show. I really appreciate all the time that you have spent with us in the last, let's say, quarter of this year. And I'm definitely going to be bringing you on, featuring you throughout next year. Again, if anybody wants some thoughts on positions that they hold in their portfolio, you can email Steve directly or myself, and I will pass on the stocks that you're wondering about, and Steve will get back to you. He's been getting back to everybody and providing a lot of helpful insights. So, Steve, really appreciate you offering that to our listeners, and I hope you have a great rest of your weekend and a very happy holiday season.
Just to talk, we've touched on it a bit in the past, Corey. If any of your listeners has a subject they'd like us to talk on, keeping in mind that for compliance reasons, I'm not allowed to mention specific company names, but if you can ask a generalized topic, we can see what we do for you.
Absolutely. Keep that in mind as well. Hey, Steve, great chatting with you. Thanks for your time.
Have a good Christmas, Corey.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, I'm back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are getting an update from Cartier Resources and the president and CEO, Philippe Cloutier. Cartier is traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol ECR and down in the U.S. under the symbol ECRFF. Now, Philippe, first and foremost, let's follow up on some news that was published just this week, December 17th, talking about Cartier publishing the maiden resource on the Benoit property. Now, this resource came in at right around 240,000 ounces of gold. That was about 134 ounces in the indicated category, 107,000 ounces in the inferred category, grading between 2.87 grams per ton gold in the indicated and 2.3 grams per ton gold equivalent in the inferred resource. Philippe, first, give us a little overview on this resource. It's coming out right before a big drill program is starting. So what is the strategy of issuing this resource ahead of the drilling?
Well, this resource or historical estimate has been known since the early 90s, but in the early 90s, when they came out with this estimate, it, like the 43-101 national instrument wasn't even around yet. And then, and at that time, it was about 500,000 tons of 5 or 6 grams of gold with some silver and copper. And then subsequently, there was some drilling by other juniors and then by ourselves. So we couldn't really refer to that number. It was like about 80,000 ounces of gold as a resource. And so we felt that with the entire data set and just on the verge of launching a major diamond drill program, that it would be good, to set in stone what this deposit is all about. And so we decided to publish a maiden resource estimate that would include the new drilling, well, all the drilling on the deposit. And so, yeah, it clocks in at just north of 220,000 ounces of gold combined, all categories, if you can do that, over 7.7 million pounds of copper and 500,000 ounces of silver. So it's not a bad start. And what it enables us to do is to engineer and dimensionalize the drilling that we'll be conducting at depth along the extension of this deposit and laterally on the other ore vision anomalies. And you'll note that in the this resource estimate we put out today, we voluntarily took out the top 100 meters of the deposit because the top of the deposit sits under a lake. And so part of our program this year is going to be to do a geotechnical, metallurgical drill program in that crown pillar. And we may be able to add an additional 100,000 ounces of gold if we're met with success. And so publishing this resource, this maiden resource, was simply to bring up to speed and into modern parlance the resource or the endowment that's present at Benoit.
So when it comes to drilling for next year, I know that's going to be a lot of the news events that comes out of the company. We will talk about what's going on at the Chimo Mine Complex, but in terms of the drill plans and overall drill goals, give us an update on what's expected for next year here at Benoit.
Yeah, well, obviously the overall goal is to grow this resource at Benoit, unlike Chimo, where, you know, we're in an emerging mining district, but yet much farther from infrastructure than we are at Chimo. So we're gunning for things like, or, you know, that are north of 2 million ounces. And so we've designed a program that's going to address the depth extension of the known deposit, the lateral extensions, the ore vision anomalies that that surround this deposit. And by the way, this deposit does have a very distinct ore vision IP geophysical signature. And those are the ore vision anomalies that we're going to be drilling within that 2 kilometer strike length. And then we're also going to be drilling the deposit itself and the upper portion to establish some geotechnical parameters as well as some metallurgy. So it's a very robust program. It starts on January 4th with 2 drill rigs, and it drills right up to and you know, mid-October to late October, almost November of 2021, nonstop, 24/7. So it's a hefty program, comprehensive. Basically, you know, tell us if this thing has you know, legs to it. Since there's going to be about 30,000 meters, you could bet there's going to be quite a few drill hole results throughout the year.
So, Philippe, I want you to give us a little bit more insight into not just the potential extension here. We've talked about drilling at depth, drilling in this crown pillar area. But one thing I'm seeing from at least some of the historic results here are generally higher grades. Almost everything that's outlined here is higher grade than what we're seeing in the actual resource estimate. Some grades going up into the double digits, into the mid-teens in terms of grams per ton gold equivalent. Where's the balance here of also finding some more high grade and potentially bumping up the overall grade of this resource?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, yeah, Benoit is one of those projects where you could easily you know, cherry pick and have really nice headliner for press releasing up. And the fact of the matter is, Benoit is a sulfide stringer system encased in a very wide, like you know, 50 to 70 meter wide true width alteration zone, heavy sulfide stringers, and you know, chalcopyrite pyrite. So this is polymetallic, and within that you're getting some really rich intervals, you know, 10 gram gold over 10 meters. But the beauty of the project is that you could really start chasing high volumes of mineralized rock, and you therefore have the luxury to push the envelope and lower the cutoff in order to optimize and go for a high ounce count. And you know, in our industry, that is the trend anyways, you know, where you can afford to bulk mine underground, well, you do it. And so the reason for this, the resource estimate was to understand the, you know, the technical parameters and geological parameters of the mineralization known at Benoit, and to bank on that and design a drill program that would address the large, the high tonnage, lower grade potential, because the drill holes are going to core through, invariably they're going to core through these really high grade sections anyways. So you'll see that in the press releases. But we tend to headline our press releases with what the project's all about anyways. It's not fair to cherry pick and only put the high grades.
I respect that, absolutely, and it's something that I'm sure we'll be discussing as we move through next year, outlining a lot of the drill results. Now, I know that it is still early on for this Benoit project. You just got this official resource out, and you do have a lot of drilling, a lot of catalysts on tap, but are there any other projects that you're looking at as a potential parallel to what Benoit could be for the company?
Yeah, well, it is, you know, it is in the... It sits right in the middle of two mines, right? There's a VMS mine 25 kilometers to the southwest, and there's a gold mine 25 kilometers to the northeast. So, you know, there's a mix and match of it's a very robust system locally, and then obviously it's in the emergent windfall deposit mining district. So this the geology of this area is going to have surprises for a lot of people. Right now we're seeing that the rocks are hosted in rocks, in geology that is highly reminiscent of what is known at La Ronde on the Cadillac Break. But we're also seeing a cluster of intrusives, felsic intrusives, within which our mineralization is also partially hosted, that is look-alike, the stuff that we're seeing at Windfall, based on what they've published in their 43-101s, the geochemistry section. So, we're really excited at walking into this program. Because we're simply going to be chasing geometry, geophysics, and vectors that are very well known at Benoit. It's going to be pretty good for us.
Perfect. Well, I'm excited to follow along. If anybody has any follow-up questions regarding Benoit, obviously just please email me, fleck@kereport.com. Let's also get an update on the Chimo Mine Complex. There's a lot of news that came out of Chimo this year. What about next year? What can investors expect?
Yeah, well, that's the fun part for us, although it's largely out of our team's hands and mostly in the hands of independent QPs. What's fun about Chimo is it's moving moving towards what we believe is going to be north of 2 million ounces, and it's basically going to be a price tag year type news for Chimo when the third resource estimate comes out, and then with the economic assessment of it. It's going to be a price tag event for Chimo.
What's the time frame in terms of the Chimo mine news flow?
Resource estimate early 2021 and mid-ish 2021. Obviously, the PEA, preliminary economic assessment. So news flow from Chimo is simply going to be those two major events with follow-up conferences and presentations specific to that news flow. And then obviously we're going to have to mix and match that with the Benoit news flow.
Okay. Just wrap us up with an update on the cash in the bank for the company to move both of these projects forward next year.
For sure. In September, we raised almost $10 million. So we sit with $14 million in the bank. So more than enough to hit all our milestones or all our objectives for next year.
Okay. Hey, Philippe, I really appreciate the update. This will be another, I think, a fairly exciting year for the company as you get on the ground at Benoit. And a lot of people that I have talked to are actually very much interested to see what you can get out of this Benoit property in terms of the drilling. Again, everybody, if you have any questions for Philippe, please email me, fleck@kereport.com. That goes for any of my guests or any of the companies that I have brought on this week through daily editorials. Philippe, I appreciate you joining us on this weekend show. Everybody else, thank you again for tuning in on this weekend. I hope you all have a great weekend, and moving into Christmas next week, I will still be recording editorials and I will be trying to catch up on some of the emails. So please, everyone, keep those emails coming and have a great holiday season.